Welcome. You are listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Conference podcast. I am the center's deputy director, Marianne Page. In January 2014, the center hosted the War on Poverty Conference. The conference hosted top poverty experts from across the country to discuss the U.S. safety net on the 50-year anniversary of the War on Poverty. In this presentation, Sarah Reber discusses the history and legacy of Title I, the 1965 legislation which sought to improve academic achievement among disadvantaged youth. Reber is an associate professor of public policy in the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs and a faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research.
Okay, so thanks so much to the organizers, and it's been really fun seeing all the papers so far, and thank you for staying on. I'm going to be talking about the history and legacy of Title I, which is Title I of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which is the K-12 battle in the War on Poverty. I'm going to be drawing on a lot of joint work with Liz Cascio and Nora Gordon throughout the talk, though I should not implicate them in this talk itself. The work is, it's a long agenda that we've had. So I'll begin with the obligatory photo of Johnson signing my piece of the War on Poverty and what he said about it. So this was in 1965 with his one of his elementary school teachers. I may be the only one to include a photo of George W. Bush, but this is the Elementary and Secondary Education Act is, and Title I in particular, is formally still with us and was last reauthorized as No Child Left Behind in 2002 and has not actually been reauthorized since then. It's supposed to be every 5 years, but I'll come back to this a little bit at the end. They basically have been funding it with continuing resolutions because they are continuing to give the money, but there is a lot of debate about the strings, and I'm going to talk a lot about the importance of the strings that come with this program. Okay, so we have seen a lot and over the last day and a half about inequality in opportunity and outcomes. Let me just start with a little bit of what things look like in the education realm in this before the War on Poverty began. So opportunities and outcomes were very unequal when the War on Poverty was declared. Looking at elementary and secondary spending, the suburbs spent about 50% more per pupil than their cities at that time, and the five highest income states spent more than twice as much as the five lowest income states, and I'm going to show you some state-level analysis. States are incredibly important in school finance. They were at the time, and they continue to be. But I'll show you how this sort of thing has evolved over time. Among 26 to 30-year-old whites in 1960, 71% were high school grads in the five highest income states, and 52% in the lowest income states. So there was across states, and a lot of this is regional, South versus the rest of the country. But there was these big gaps across places, and for blacks, so you can see also the black-white gaps were enormous, and also within each race, looking across space by income, there were these very large gaps in attainment. So the Elementary and Secondary Education Act was meant to address these inequities, and it represented a fundamental change in the role of the federal government in K-12 education, which had, from the founding, been a very local and state-level endeavor. And there's sort of three ways in which we see this as having changed the role of the federal government. I'm going to talk a little bit about each of these. So first of all, it was big, and I'm going to come back later and say it was really way too small in terms of trying to address the inequities that existed, but it doubled federal spending for K-12 education at the time. So the prior programs were the largest programs pre-existing excuse me, were the National Defense Education Act, which was a post-Sputnik sort of we need to be educated so that we can fight the Soviets kind of thing, and the Federal Impact Aid, which went to school districts that served Native Americans and that had military presence and things like that. So this Title I, which is the largest component of ESEA, was large. It doubled spending, but it was also compensatory or progressive. So the distribution of aid was specifically related to poverty, and that had not previously been the case. And actually, this time period is essentially the birth of the progressive progressive spending on K-12 education. The third aspect is that this money had strings attached. So in the past, the federal aid, you know, again, it was viewed that K-12 education was to be done by local school districts and states. The federal government shouldn't be butting in. That's still largely the case in many ways, but this was sort of the first time that the funding for K-12 education was tied to other social policies and initially school desegregation, and that's going to be a very important part of the legacy of Title I. So Title I was by far the largest component of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, both by money and I think in terms of policy. Later on in the 70s, other things were added. I was talking to a student yesterday about migrant education was added, and Title I was and remains the biggest component, and I'm going to basically only talk about Title I going forward. Okay, so what was the Title I program? It has changed a lot, but also not changed a lot. But let me talk about what the program looked like at its inception. So from an economics perspective, the Title I program is a restricted block grant from the federal government to a local school district where the targeted good is educational services for poor kids. Okay, so technically the money goes from the federal government to the state education agency and then it's divided up to local school districts. It, particularly in the beginning of the program, the state education agency doesn't do anything. It's basically a pass-through. So from an economic perspective, you can really think of this as money that's going from the federal government directly to local school districts. The money is supposed to be spent on educational services for educationally disadvantaged students. That's the targeted good. It's supposed to be supplemental. It does not. There's no matching component, so it doesn't change the relative price of the targeted good versus other goods. So actually, this you can basically, if you can go back to the graph that Hillary showed for food stamps, it's the same. That's the analysis that you would do. That basically this is income to local school districts. One thing I think is interesting, I myself have put that graph in my papers in terms of the motivation for thinking about how local school districts might respond to receiving this income. If you think back to microeconomics, now then we're going to put preferences in there. It's not an individual, it's a government. So there are interesting questions. People often say, okay, it's the preferences of the median voter, but you actually need to take on whether that's how decisions are getting made in local school districts, but that's the structure of the program. Okay, so initially there was very little regulation over the use of funds. So this is in contrast to enforcement of the Civil Rights Act aspect of this, which I'll come back to, but basically I think there were about three people in the Office of Education who were responsible for monitoring the use of this $1 billion in federal money. But my understanding and reading of the history, and also you can see it in the data, is that Johnson was committed to enforcing the desegregation requirements that came along with Title I, and they did withhold funds from some districts, and they did monitor that. Over time, the program became highly regulated. Okay, so this is very much in contrast to now, and I think this is an important legacy, long-term legacy of the program. And this was in response to basically concerns about misuse of funds and concerns about crowd out, which were, I think, well-founded. In 1969, the NAACP released a report showing, you know, a lot of misuse of funds in ways that were racially motivated, but also just in general, you know, using Title I funds for band uniforms and things like that. And that this led to sort of a lot of concern about this and a lot of regulation over the funds. Now, if I have economists of education or educators in the room, they don't think about Title I like this today. So most educators, policymakers today think of Title I as kind of a set of educational services, okay? So there are Title I schools, and those are schools that are eligible to receive Title I programs. There are Title I funds. There are Title I programs. There are Title I students who participate in those programs. And that's something that's come out of this kind of regulation that's changed over time. But in the beginning of the program, I think it's really proper to think of it as just a money transfer in the form of a restricted block grant. But I will talk about the federally mandated evaluations of the program because these affect, I think, the public perception and educator perception of the program. And they're really consistent with this idea of Title I as more like an educational intervention. So let me start with, this is not any of my work, but let me start just with a brief discussion of what that, what people think of as the Title I literature, which is reasonably large, what this, what these studies show. So there were federally mandated evaluations of this program. I think this is something that as social scientists who work with data, we think should be in all legislation. And then you see that 50 years later, we're sitting here, they've done these studies, and we know basically nothing. So we need to mandate that there be a research design, I guess. I think it's a really interesting question for us here 50 years later evaluating these programs is, you know, what should we be? How should we be on an ongoing basis? Judging the success, but I guess I've sort of given away the punchline, which is I feel these studies are bad, but let me tell you what they say. And actually many of the authors, to their credit, they understand the limitations, and you know, but they're federally mandated and they have to do something, so they do the best they can. So what do? They compare students participating in Title I programs to some comparison group, and they generally find that Title I is not so effective. But it's, you know, there's a very difficult selection problem here of, you know, who's participating in the Title I programs. How do you find a good comparison group? And they have different approaches to this. But in general, it's, you know, there's no quasi-random or random variation that they can exploit. And these are going to give you the benefits of Title I overall as a program only if there's no crowd out. Okay, so by this I mean that the services received by the treated students are new services. And I'm going to talk about there's many ways in which crowd out can happen and where that you could have students participating in programs that are called Title I programs and are being bought with Title I money, but they're not actually getting any educational services that they wouldn't have gotten in the absence of the program, okay? Or they're not getting, not all of that represents new services. So you need that to be true, and you also need it to be that there's no spillovers, okay? So it could be that that non-participating students also benefit. Okay, now that, you know, so for example, the money could be used on educational services for students who don't really qualify for Title I. Now, that's not the intent of the program, but there could be a benefit to that. You could be, you know, I would not expect this to be a major mechanism, but many of these programs are pull-out programs, so you could imagine, you know, by taking those kids who are participating out and giving them extra services, that frees up resources for, you know, the remaining kids or something like that. So there are many ways in which there could be spillover. So you can think of it as, you know, you're treating your controls, and you may not be treating your treated. And there's lots of good reasons to believe that, you know, one or both of those don't hold. So we've argued, you know, that conceptually we should take a broader approach to thinking about this this program and all the different kinds of effects it could have, aside from the issue that even within this approach, there's this selection problem that nobody has particularly solved. So there's a, I guess, small to medium-sized literature that economists have participated in on Title I, which basically I would say kind of like worries about all kind of crowd out. Okay, so what does that mean? What is crowd out? Crowd out is just the idea that you might give new money to schools to spend on poor kids, and they might spend that on poor kids, but then they might reduce some other spending on poor kids, and it could happen in other ways as well. So who can crowd out? So remember that the money comes from the federal government and goes to a local school district. The state doesn't really do anything with the money, but the state also gives money to the local school district, okay? So one way that crowd out could happen is that the states, and this actually is illegal, but seems quite reasonable in a way. The state might say, look out in the world and say, oh, my poor schools are getting this money from the federal government, and they're doing better than they would have been doing without that money, and so I'm gonna have a funding formula that's less progressive than I would have otherwise had, okay? So, and I mean, you could have that in an extreme form where the state has a preference about, you know, what is the progressivity of funding, and it completely offsets what the feds are doing, okay? So that's one possibility. Another possibility, which is what, you know, the sort of fiscal federalism literature tends to focus on in general, is that local school districts might reduce their own effort, okay? So local school districts, and this is what you would get in the model that the picture that Hillary had with a median voter who wants to spend on education and wants to spend on other goods. You give them some income, they spend a little bit of that on education, but then they can also reduce taxes. You wouldn't expect them to spend every dollar of new income on education. So you would see either a reduction in tax in local property taxes or increase in spending on other local services, depending on kind of whether the school district was part of another government or not. You can also see this happen at the school level. So, you know, schools can, if they were already doing extra services for poor kids, they should just start using Title I funds for that and then using their other, the funding that's freed up from that for other things. Okay, so where might the money go? It could go to educational services for ineligible kids or schools. It could go to ineligible educational expenditures. So, for example, capital. So it's meant to be current instruction. Or it could go, you know, just to private consumption. So it could be paid back to local taxpayers or state taxpayers. There's probably more things I could list out here. And it's important to keep in mind that the funds could be nominally used for intended purposes, but still not increase educational services for poor children. And this, you know, this is why you can't just yet. Yes, there's tons of documentation about how these funds are spent, although I'm actually becoming increasingly interested in looking at that, even though you don't know if that was the actual additional services that were provided. And given that, there's lots of anecdotal evidence of nominal misuse of funds, okay? So districts just basically report that they're using their funds on things that aren't allowed. So there's good reason to worry about that. So there's a few papers in this literature that are going to try to look at when the federal government gives this money, how much does it actually increase instructional spending. So let me show you one graph from a paper that Liz and Nora and I did looking at the introduction of Title I in the South and how that affected spending. So I'll just walk through this a little bit. I'm now embarrassed by Ken that I have my vertical lines, but I feel like at least in A, you would have been able to place it, but not all of us have as much data as you know, so we have to resort to this. But so what this is showing is each of these points is The coefficient from a regression on, in this case, per pupil federal revenue, on the poverty rate. Okay, so it's saying, what is the relationship between poverty and federal revenue? And you can see that initially it was slightly negative, okay? And then after 1965, or starting in 1965, it becomes positive. And basically the slope is roughly equal to the per poor student Title I allocation, okay? So there is, I don't have the graph that that Martha had, but we had it in the paper, which basically shows, like, did they follow the formula?
Right.
And, yes, and they more or less did follow the formula. One thing that's interesting, and I'll comment to Martha in, inappropriately in my own talk, that in 1965, the reason that it's not, that coefficient is lower is partly because the per poor kid grant was lower at that time, but also districts in the South didn't receive their money. And so there, you have a certain amount of districts who are not receiving their money because of desegregation, noncompliance, and that just creates noise. It makes it look like the formula wasn't implemented and reduced the R squared and things like that. And then, you know, after we get out a few years, districts are receiving their money. Okay, so that's just the first stage saying, yes, the money was distributed as expected. And then this second graph shows per pupil current expenditure. Okay, so you can see, first of all, it's interesting that before, in the early 60s, spending was regressive. So poor places spend less within states. So these all have state fixed effects in them. And you actually find the same thing without state fixed effects within this. This is within the South. But then you see an increase after 1965 in the relationship between poverty and spending, and it becomes actually progressive. But the change there is just about half of the change over there. And interestingly, you don't see, there's just nothing going on at the state level. Like, it's moderately, it is moderately progressive, and it stays so. So it's like a non-result, but it's actually a result because the state could have said, you know, hey, we're going to offset this, but they're just not changing what they're doing. So the offset is coming in a reduction in the progressivity of local revenue. And if you look really carefully, you'll see there's like 20 cents we don't account for, and it bothers me, but I'm not going to go into it now. Okay, so that's from one of the studies, and that's one study that we've worked on in this fiscal federalism literature. Marty Feldstein had one of the early ones in the 70s. Nora Gordon worked on this in a later time period. This is from the study that I just talked about. And there's a range of estimates, but they all find evidence of economically significant crowd-out, so there's not a one-for-one increase in spending with with the grant. But it tends to be less crowd-out than you would expect from the neoclassical model. I should mention also the studies are in a slightly different spirit but related. There's some regression discontinuity studies that try to use the fact that there's a poverty threshold that to qualify to be a Title I school. And so they try to use that to identify the effects of Title I on outcomes. But what ends up happening is they find no discontinuity in resources at the threshold, which, you know, suggests that there's some form of crowding out going on because the money is supposed to be layered on top of whatever the school would have had. So on the one hand, that seems like a major lack of compliance. I also look at that, though, and I think, like, it can't possibly be optimal to, like, spend, to have this huge discontinuity in resources that are allocated. And, you know, so maybe what districts are doing is they're, I mean, it's equally possible that they're undoing it at the school level in a way that makes sense. Although, anyway, you can't tell that in the data, but I don't know that they do anything that makes sense. But so this raises the question of what's the incidence. You know, if you're from the economic perspective, it's not like this money that was crowded out just like disappeared from the world. It went to tax relief or whatever. From a perspective of understanding this program, I think, you know, this is clearly not the intent. And it's not, you're not going to get the effects you want in terms of improving education if the money's not going for that, or you won't get as much as you want. We find in this paper, you know, what I would call suggestive evidence, it's mainly the data aren't that great, that there were improvements in educational attainment for Southern whites in this period, but not for blacks, which is also something that is disappointing, and because you would have maybe expected more for blacks. We speculate that that might be because still in the 70s, it was probably, or in the late 60s, it was probably possible to allocate that funding inequitably by race, whereas starting in the 70s, that would have been much much harder. That's correct. Yeah, this study ends in 1969. Yeah, and we don't have estimates going after that. Okay, so let me. This part is from the chapter we did for the Legacies book, and I'm just gonna show you how at the state level relationships among educational spending, attainment, poverty, and income have changed over time. Okay, and this can be at the state level. It's as I said, the state is pretty important in school finance, and we're going to see some pretty striking relationships. But you know, this is a purely descriptive analysis to kind of understand what's been happening in the last 50 years. So I have to start with this graph by way of background. The purple line is current expenditure per pupil in real terms from the mid-50s through, they have very long lags on releasing these data, but through the mid-2000s, and federal revenue per pupil. So there's basically 2 points I want to make about this graph. One is we spend a lot more on education than we did in the past. I think, you know, Rick Hanushek has this graph or some form of it in many of his papers, and you know, then goes on to argue that we're wasting a lot of money and we're not getting, you know, there's inefficiency. I actually think that you can't tell that from this graph, but we need to take seriously that argument. But in any case, there's a big increase over time. The other thing I want to point out is how small this is, how you can barely see. I mean, I could put this on a scale where you would really see a jump in 65, but I think a relevant scale is this one. Now, that said, in the average Southern school district, the 1965 grant was 20% of pre-program spending. So it was substantial for some districts, but federal revenue, as many people have pointed out, has never been a super important part of K-12 spending. Okay.
I don't know why there's a difference between
you
and graph and
Okay, you'll tell.
Because mine is a percentage of
GDP. Right, I know, yeah. Well, we should figure it out, because... okay, so let me show you how the relationship between spending and poverty has changed. So I knew that Gavin would be here, and so I almost didn't even, I got in trouble last time for saying there was no South effect. So let me tell you what this graph shows, and maybe have a slightly more nuanced way of describing it. So this is the 1960 child poverty rate. This actually based on data we've used for Title I. So this is the poverty rate that's implied by the way that they allocated the Title I funds, but it's very closely related to anything else you would use. And this is the log of per pupil spending in the state. So you can just see that there's this incredibly tight relationship and really steep slope at the state level. Poverty is very predictive of state level spending in 1963. The South, which for me the South is the former Confederacy, so the states of the former Confederacy are in red. They're very much on the line, but I think it's totally correct. And so, if you were to put a South fixed effect in this regression, it is not significant. And so, in that sense, there's no South effect. But I think it's completely right that you have notice how much the red states are here and the green states are there. The figure over here is showing the same thing in 2006. So you can see that two things. One, there's still a slope. Three things. There's still a negative slope. It's much flatter. And there's all this kind of unexplained variation. So particularly you see that the among the low poverty states, they're just doing like different things. Okay, now some of it you might understand, like California is going to be lower down, and New York and New Jersey are, you know, these higher spending states. So poverty has become less predictive of spending over time, but there's still a very strong relationship. This is the same 1960 child poverty rate. Actually, if you use the contemporaneous poverty rate, it basically looks the same with a sort of shift in the poverty rates are really persistent over time within states. So this will be my closest in this section to I'll suggest a causal effect of ESEA. So this is just showing the gradient. So the slope from those two endpoints that I presented before, this is plotting that slope every year, okay? And you do see, I mean, there's just, like, I do need to put the line here. There's a big break in 1965. So spending becomes a lot more progressive, as you'd expect. But it's just the gradient is so huge. So Liz and I estimate that to flatten that slope, assuming, you know, no crowd out of any kind, the program would have need to be 7 times larger than it was. And that's at the state level, you know, using the gradient at the state level. So there, and if you kind of said, okay, I'm going to take this as the counterfactual and then project that out, then kind of what it looks like is that ESEA kind of moved ahead by 10 or 15 years, this reduction in, or increase in progressivity of school spending. Okay, so what happened to outcomes? I think Sean is gonna talk more about this. I was glad he was my discussant because he knows more about it. But this is from the census and the ACS looking at just trends in attainment. So the blue lines are high school graduation rates, and the white rate is above the non-white rate. And this is by cohort. So here, these cohorts were not exposed. These cohorts were partially exposed, and then these cohorts were fully exposed. So you would expect, if there were a large effect of Title I and also nothing else going on, you'd expect sort of flat and then up, and like Hillary had that nice graph. We see actually something that's consistent with that for college, but not for high school. And we really, it would just be really surprising if Title I had an effect on college attainment without having some effect on high school attainment. So we don't really want to make too much of that. But you can see also just the trends and what's been happening. There's a lot of convergence between blacks and whites at high school, but not so much in college. And, you know, there's a big increase in educational attainment across the board. I don't have it here, but we looked at the correlation, that geographic inequality in outcomes, and that also has declined dramatically. So the gradient of attainment in the poverty rate of the state has fallen quite a lot, too. So I think, you know, those are good developments, but there's still a lot left. Okay, so just to summarize the trends in funding and attainment, the spending is incredibly unequal across states and strongly negatively correlated with poverty. Like I said, we would have needed really a much larger program. So that's the sense in which I think, you know, this program was very large when you look at it from the perspective of what the federal government had been doing for K-12 education, but it was tiny compared to the inequities in funding that existed. Poverty is less predictive, and the slope's less steep over time. We look at what might explain the variation, and it does over time. Income, the median income of place, becomes more predictive than poverty, whereas in the early periods, just poverty is really but there's just more unexplained variation. I think this is interesting. There's the school finance equalization movement. So I think part of what's going on is just as states are changing a lot what they're doing, and they're changing it in different ways. And the educational attainment gaps between high and low poverty states are narrowing over time. Okay, so let me talk about this, the strings. So we have a federal system. The Constitution prohibits the federal government from telling states or local governments what to do. So if the federal government wants to actually influence non-fiscal aspects of policy, they have to tie that to money. And they did that in K-12 education with Title I and have initially and since. So for this reason that the effects of Title I extend beyond the grant making, let me just put these up. There's several ways that I think are important. I'm going to talk primarily about desegregation in my remaining 8 minutes. So initially, Title I was tied to desegregation in the same way that the hospital desegregation was tied to the receipt of Medicare funds. And in the South, there was just more mixed outside of the South. I think it's also important that the experience of Title I has influenced the design of programs since then. And there, Marguerite Rosa and some other school finance scholars feel that now funding is so regulated that basically when you find yourself with lawyers designing your instructional program, you're not in a good place. And that's kind of... this is a very indirect link, but that's sort of one of the legacies of Title I that I think needs to be addressed. Title I receipt more recently when reauthorizes NTLB tied to accountability, and now implicitly, and I'll maybe say a little bit more of this later, tied to Common Core, teacher evaluation, the other kinds of things that the Department of Education now wants states to do. Let me give this paper in one slide. When Title I funds were first available in 1965, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare issued guidelines that said this is what you need to do in terms of desegregation in order to get these funds. Okay, so in 1965, they basically said you need to put a black kid in school with a white kid. In 1966, it was complicated, but they said you need to transfer 2 to 6%, maybe up to 12% of students, black students to white schools. Starting in 67, they started to say you can't have black schools and white schools. You need to have just schools. Actually, that's language that is in green and was actually originally in the HEW guidelines. So over time, the guidelines got more stringent. So this... this figure is showing, if we start with this line, the share of school districts in the South, the former Confederacy, that had any desegregation, and you can see there's a huge increase following the Civil Rights Act and Title I. Is there any black student in school with a white student in the entire school district? So it's the extensive margin. This one is the fraction of blacks in all black schools, and then you have the more usual dissimilarity index, okay? So these are really dramatic changes. This is CRA-ESEA. Green is an important Supreme Court decision. Swan was another important Supreme Court decision that that basically said you could do busing. We have a paper that looks explicitly at the districts that have more money on the line, were they more likely to desegregate? We find that that's the case in a statistically significant way, but it does not explain very much of that huge trend. So let me go on this slide. So so there's clearly something going on at this time. It may not be explicitly the financial incentives. There's also the aspect of, having HEW saying this is what it means to desegregate. The courts were having trouble, by all accounts, figuring out what Brown meant. I think there was an interaction among the Congress, the courts, and the executive. So it required the efforts of all three, and the Title I and the Civil Rights Act were a really important piece of that. And we do find that more districts, districts who had more money on the line were more likely to desegregate voluntarily, and that were less likely to be under court order eventually, so that, sort of freed up the resources of the court. After Johnson left office, the courts became really super important. Like, they stopped enforcing these parts of the civil rights, the fund withholding provisions of the Civil Rights Act. And so then there, I'll summarize medium-sized literature that basically seems to all point to the idea that desegregation was helpful for blacks in terms of educational attainment and other outcomes. So I think this is a really, it's really important to consider this to be part of the legacy of Title I. Okay, so I would say, you know, overall, the ESEA has, you know, a mixed legacy. So if we think about it as an instructional intervention, which I think is actually not the right way of thinking about it, but how many people do, it's a weak program. So as an instructional intervention, I think these programs are considered to be poorly designed and weak and, you know, not consistent enough. So it wouldn't be surprising if that wasn't super helpful, but then also the evidence about that is basically weak. So, you know, we kind of don't, I wouldn't expect these programs to be, to have, you know, very large effects, but we don't really know. So as if, it's being a little broader and thinking of it as a funding stream, I think it's first of all important to consider that, you know, this was a program that was pretty big, but way too small in terms of the, you know, if you think that money matters for education and that is the solution, you need to equalize it, and you look at those the inequalities of outcome and spending that existed beforehand, it just, you know, it's just tiny. So you know, having said that, on top of that, there was some crowd out, but some what we would call flypaper effect, which means definitely some of the money did seem to increase spending. And you know, over time, there is this weakening of the relationship between poverty and spending at the state level. I have been collecting for about the past 10 years data, you know, at the school district level outside the South, and, you know, maybe 5 years. Maybe at the 60th anniversary, I can present that to you. I think there's another thing lurking in the background, which is really important, which is, you know, the literature is kind of called Does Money Matter? I would like to revise that to be sort of like how and when can money matter. It's clear that you cannot educate children without some resources, but there are serious questions about, you know, how the marginal dollar is spent and how much it matters. And in fact, this was, you know, this was a problem for Title I from the get-go, that, you know, soon after this legislation began, or these programs began, the Coleman Report came out and sort of suggested that, well, you know, first of all, the black schools aren't that much worse than the white schools, and money doesn't, you know, money doesn't matter. It's all about family. And basically, we still don't know the answer to that question. But, you know, that has been going on in the background the whole time. Okay, in terms of the strings, the more than money aspect of this program, I think this is really important. It did fundamentally alter the federal role. I think that desegregation is a clear success, especially in the South. And the courts were really important. I have other work that shows that the courts were important, and so I have to, you know, I have to say that also. But I think that this was an important. It's not a coincidence that after 10 years, things started happening in the South in 1965. It still, you know, took some time, but I mean, really, in 5 years. It, you know, it was delayed, and then in 5 years, the schools desegregated and became, you know, the least segregated region in the country. That I mentioned about the regulation. So NCLB accountability, you know, so if you want to think about the legacy of this legislation, you need to have a view on, you know, basically all of the strings that have been attached to it over time. There is some evidence that NCLB has increased achievement. And so more recently, I mentioned that the legislation has not been authorized. So basically what's going on now is that there's this waiver process. And so the strings are you need to do what Department of Education wants you to do to get a waiver, basically to get your money, because none of them can really comply. You know that this is the year that we closed that we got everybody proficient. So these, So, you know, now it's kind of the common core teacher evaluation. We don't know what the effects of these things are, but, that's kind of what's being tied to this now. So I started with the picture, and I'll end with the we're not done with this work slide. So there have been a lot of changes in school funding since 1965. I think, you know, one of the most dramatic is just the level spending on K-12 education has quadrupled since 1960. There's a more progressive distribution of funding, and I put that in italics because I'm not at all sure how closely that's related to the progressivity of the distribution of, you know, opportunity or resources more properly measured. There's less flexibility in local control. There's persistent racial gaps in attainment, achievement, and wages, and growing SES achievement gaps, which after all were the things that were targeted by this legislation. Oh, what a drag to end on, to end on that note. But thank you, and I'll turn it over to Sean.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.